You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And are you mad as hell? I mean, are you out on the ledge? Are you going to take it for one more minute? I mean, what am I going to do with that kind of anger?
I want you to get up now.
Okay, Mr. Beale, get up and then do what?
Go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell!
You want me to say what?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And what exactly is that going to accomplish? Accomplish? Perhaps not much. But carve a place in the zeitgeist? Peter Finch as Howard Beale, acting the lines Paddy Chayefsky wrote for the movie Network, released in 1976, attained almost instant immortality. We'll talk about the angry man of Hollywood and whether he accomplished anything later this hour. Also in 1976, it was the first time ice dancing was in the Olympics, and the U.S. won a bronze medal back then, but not much since. It was an ice dancing gold yesterday at the Sochi Olympics, though. We'll talk about that. Also, a look at religion and politics in Iran, the Vatican, and the U.S. We'll also explore how blaming the U.S. is still an effective political tactic in both Iran and Venezuela. But our starting point this hour is Iran. Talks have resumed in Vienna between Iran and six world powers to try and cement a nuclear deal. It's a complicated, difficult, and lengthy process. That's how one U.S. official described the next few days. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has insisted Iran has the political will to reach a deal. But that optimism contrasts with remarks from Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who spoke earlier this week. That's Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, speaking in Farsi, and he's saying this. They try to portray its government as friendly, referring to the United States. They should not do so. It is futile. What's playing out in Austria, the first high-level talk since an interim deal was agreed in November of last year. Thomas Erdbrink joins us from Tehran. He's the bureau chief in Tehran for our partner, the New York Times. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's certainly not news that the supreme leader would differ with the political leader in Iran. What do you make of the optimism from one side of the government and apparent pessimism from the other side?
Well, first of all, the Ayatollah's pessimism was a lot more straightforward. He actually said that the nuclear talks, and I quote, would lead to nowhere. So he has been increasingly dismissive of any chance of a solution, dismissive of any form of relationships between Iran and the United States. And therefore, it is indeed very paradoxical to hear Iran's foreign minister say that he hopes for a solution within 6 months, and Iran's most powerful man, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, to say that these talks will not lead to anything.
You know, I saw a headline in the Los Angeles Times, which characterized a lot of the analysis leading up to these Vienna talks, in that the six powers that are in these talks, I mean, or the world powers who are facing Iran across the table in these talks, are really looking for a way to make it look like Iran is going to win here, that that's one of the chief challenges. Is that how you see it?
Well, if that is indeed their goal, and I actually think their goal is to make sure that Iran will not in any way be able to produce openly or secretly a nuclear program. But if that's their goal, to try and help out the Iranians from the hole that they have been digging themselves into, it's going to be a very hard task. For 10 years, the Iranian political leaders have been insisting on their nuclear program. They have been expanding their nuclear program, and they've always been connecting their nuclear program to their ideology. Basically, they're saying if we lose our nuclear program, we lose everything we fought for since the establishment of the Islamic Republic 35 years ago. So it will be very hard to make this look like, as President Rouhani, Iran's president, calls it, a win-win situation for both sides.
Now, it's something that you've reported on, even, that on the streets of Iran, and particularly Tehran, among young people, there is a sense of optimism that Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has actually given President Rouhani a longer leash, a bit of discretion here in these talks. Is it your sense that these latest remarks from Khamenei suggest that that leash is getting shorter, didn't exist at all, that Rouhani is going to be sandbagged like other Iranian political leaders of the past?
Well, Mr. Rouhani definitely faces a very difficult task, mainly also because of the promises he's been making to those young people. He has been saying, we'll solve the nuclear case, we'll reconnect with the outside world, we'll turn Iran into a normal country once again. And of course, Iran's ideology, very well guarded by Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, doesn't allow for normal relations with, let's say, for instance, the United States. And yesterday, Mr. Khamenei was very clear on that. He said, look, we will never, ever in the history of the Islamic Republic and in the future of the Islamic Republic see the United States as a normal country because they are against us.
On the streets of Iran, is there discussion of how many centrifuges for enriching uranium that will be discussed in Vienna? Is there a number that's being batted around? Do people have that level of understanding of the detail here?
Well, it's very much so that people very closely follow these nuclear talks, especially people, you know, who are making up Iran's middle class, the traders, the academics, the artists. And they don't count the number of centrifuges and they don't make red lights for themselves. They're more kind of caught between their own nationalism and pride, even though they might not agree with everything Iran's leaders do, and on one hand, and also with the sense of reality on the other hand. And if you look at the picture of Iran's economy, yes, of course, many people on the streets are hoping for a compromise. There's very high unemployment. Inflation is higher than 40%. Prices are rising all the time. And Iran has no option to sell its oil on international markets, so therefore is not having any income, which will only make things worse further down the line. So if you ask normal people, yes, of course, they want a compromise.
Thomas Erdbrink is the Tehran bureau chief. He joined us from Tehran, Iran correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thomas Erdbrink, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To the Vatican now, an arcane bureaucratic meeting of the Pope and the Catholic Church's most senior cardinals this week to discuss finances just might turn into a visionary restatement of the Church's values and priorities under the apparently exciting new leadership of Pope Francis. Joining us is James Carroll, author of the upcoming novel set at the Vatican, Warburg in Rome. He's a scholar in residence at Suffolk University. James Carroll, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, John.
First of all, what do you make of the turn that Pope Francis is apparently trying to make, and how do you think it might be reflected at a discussion of the financial priorities of the Church at this meeting this week?
Well, you know, he said in a very pointed way in his so-called apostolic exhortation in November, quote, "The Church is not a toll house. It's the house of the Father where there's a place for everyone." Well, the truth is the Catholic Church has been acting exactly like a toll house for a long time. You have to qualify to be admitted and to be admitted to the sacraments. And the question of divorce and remarriage is central to that. And what Pope Francis has indicated in a variety of ways is it's time for a major change in the way we think of not just that particular issue, divorce and remarriage, but the Church itself. The slogan he's lifted up himself is, "This is a time of mercy, not judgment."
And mercy becomes a kind of recruitment tool in the sense that you have millions of people out there who have been denied communion, denied sort of sacramental access to the Church, who may all of a sudden be back in the fold, which would make the Church much more powerful than it has been up until now.
It's true, and you know, the way you just put it is instructive because those millions of people are the Church. Francis has brought back the vision of Vatican II, which defined the Church as the people of God, not the bishops and the priests. And in a way, the Church has already spoken on the question of divorce and remarriage in the ordinary lives of human beings, the Catholic people, And finally, the hierarchy is listening. So that's why there is, I believe, good reason to expect change. I myself think that at very least we'll see it in the synod in October of this year, where preparations are already including serious discussions by church leaders of this question of divorce and remarriage and readmission to the sacraments. So there are signals loud and clear that change is coming on this.
And this is a meeting about finances, and presumably there will be much discussion of what the Pope has already said about the Church's view of dealing with poverty, dealing with social problems around the world. Why would marriage and divorce come up at a meeting like this? And describe the particular sort of phrase that is at least targeted to possibly be changed here.
Well, this particular meeting, first of all, there's a meeting of the so-called Council of Eight going on now ahead of the so-called consistory, which is the gathering where new cardinals are named by the Pope to the College of Cardinals, which will happen later this week. And the so-called Council of Eight has taken on a number of really large and pressing issues for the Pope, joining him in considering these critical and problematic questions. The integrity of the church financial systems is one, obviously. But there are these, you might call them in-house questions that are pressing on the lives of Catholics as well. Divorce and remarriage is another of those. I'm sorry to say that not high enough on the list of priorities here is the recovery from the terrible priestly sex abuse scandal, and we're hoping to see some more action from church leaders on that question. But it's very clear that Pope Francis has a comprehensive agenda for change in the church. It begins with a basic change in attitude. His attitude has already set in motion profound changes that reach from the pragmatic and institutional, like finances, to the moral and spiritual, like the meaning of the sacraments, and the true and ongoing need for church repentance and change over this question of sex abuse.
Irreversible at this point before we go?
I wouldn't say irreversible, no, but I think it's the movement has been set powerfully in motion, and I think there are reasons to be very hopeful, even optimistic, about the coming changes.
Always great to talk to you. James Carroll, author of An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us and Toward a New Catholic Church, The Promise of Reform. He's also a columnist for the Boston Globe. His upcoming novel set at the Vatican is called Warburg in Rome. James, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Once upon a time, you might have found those stories we were just talking about on a front page of a newspaper, but now how you get updates about what's going on in the world and how you make any meaningful sense of it are two different things. News happens 24/7. Thoughtful understanding doesn't. Anytime news is convenient.
Hi, my name is Kim Goodner. I'm calling from Everettville, Illinois. The nice thing about having the 24-hour news, if you have an awkward schedule, you can turn it on and watch it. Give it that half hour so it gives you all the main things you need to know, and you can turn it off.
But beyond convenience, from Tallahassee, Florida, very bad, you write, of the 24-hour news cycle. Instead of hearing a news report and ruminating about what it means, we simply watch the same report over and over. Pitiful. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or facebook.com/thetakeaway. Later this hour, the movie Network and the networks it skewered on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Political instability in Venezuela is being blamed on the United States. The expulsion of diplomats is either an attempt by the Venezuelan president to try and expose alleged U.S. meddling in Venezuelan affairs, or a long-standing political tactic by President Nicolas Maduro to divert attention from domestic criticism to that evil superpower up north. On the ground in Caracas, BBC reporter Irina Caselli tells us that President Maduro is returning to a familiar theme.
This is nothing new when it comes to Venezuela, the expulsion of U.S. diplomats. Just in little over a year, President Maduro has already expelled diplomats in three different occasions. Once it was actually on the 5th of March, the same day that the death of Hugo Chavez was announced. So in a sense, we can say that this is a tactic that he took from his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. And at the same time, we can also say that there are some concerns that popular classes have here when it comes to the opposition. Let's not forget that in 2002, the opposition was involved in a coup against Mr. Chavez that briefly removed him from power. So it's not that difficult to convince certain people, government supporters, that the opposition may be trying something similar again.
But it is certainly the case that President Maduro does not have the kind of charismatic hold on the people of Venezuela. He can't make the argument as effectively, and he can't count on their faith and hope for a better future.
That you're completely correct. Mr. Maduro is very different from Mr. Chavez. At the same time, though, the same popular base that voted for Mr. Chavez is still sort of giving Mr. Maduro the benefit of the doubt. Things are very difficult in Venezuela, especially when it comes to the economy and insecurity. But the popular sectors that voted for Mr. Chavez over and over again are worried that the opposition, if it were to win, may take away all the rights that Mr. Chavez gave them. Of course, within this scenario, we need to remember as well that there are no elections in sight. And actually, Leopoldo López, this opposition leader that is leading the marches on Tuesday, is sort of looking for extreme measures is trying to get a lot of attention. He's trying to capitalize on the general discontent against the government. But it's very unlikely that these marches will actually lead to any change in the government.
Irina Caselli, BBC correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We go now to Rory Carroll, U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Guardian, author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, out in paperback in the U.S. this month. Rory, welcome.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about those domestic issues on the street in Caracas and elsewhere in Venezuela that are really mobilizing some of this criticism of the government of Mr. Maduro.
Under Hugo Chavez, there was an accumulation of policy blunders rooted in reckless populism. There were economic exchange controls and price controls, expropriations, which over the years warped the economy and produced these economic problems we see now of rampant inflation, acute and chronic shortages of basic goods. And in addition to that, there was a lot of incompetence in terms of just public safety. Police, the courts, the jails were often left in a chaotic state, leading to one of the highest murder rates in the world. And people just got fed up with this. Now, Nicolas Maduro, when he took over last year, he inherited these problems, but he's proved so far ineffective in resolving them. And so a lot of the anger and resentment we're seeing in Venezuela today just stems from this accumulation of blunders, really.
I'm wondering if there's an incompetence that could also be laid at the feet of the opposition in the sense that procedurally there's just nothing that can happen here short of a giant constitutional revolution. And so the opposition is kind of dissipating its sense of anger and passion for almost no foreseeable benefit.
Yes, there has to be a question mark over whether the opposition here is blundering, because Nicolas Maduro is a relatively weak president in that his own side, Chavismo, is quite divided. A lot of Chavistas are uncertain about him. They're not sure if he's really up to the job or if he's ideologically pure enough. And so he has been really facing a lot of criticism internally from his own people. And yet now there's elements of the opposition, by raising the stakes, by turning very radical, they've allowed him to change the conversation from now no longer talking really about shortages and inflation and the fiasco that is the Venezuelan economy. Instead, Nicolas Maduro can now talk about defending the revolution from fascists and Nazis and the bourgeoisie. And this plays to his strengths and could well force or make Chavistas feel compelled to rally around the revolutionary banner.
And makes the charge that the U.S. is meddling in Venezuelan affairs suddenly much more convincing, hence the expulsion of diplomats.
Yes, and it also adds to the kind of the multiple ironies at play here. For example, in my book, I mentioned how in the coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002, the U.S. administration of George Bush did tacitly back it. One of the key events of that coup was that the media did not show events on the streets. The media were in favor of the coup, and they did not show these huge crowds rallying in support of Hugo Chavez, to the point that it became a catchphrase, "The revolution will not be televised." And yet now, you know, we're seeing more than a decade later, the boot is on the other foot. The government has achieved what it calls effective media hegemony. Either the television is all state-controlled or it's privately controlled, but is cowed by fear of the government. So that means now that ordinary Venezuelans are not seeing a lot of the images that we can see of people on the street, or we're reduced to, you know, seeing fragments of it on social media, because the government has got very effective instruments for trying to craft the message in the way it wants to.
And they're very much in control at this point, even amidst the dissatisfaction in Venezuela. Rory Carroll, U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Guardian, author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez is Venezuela, speaking to us from Los Angeles. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, John.
A breathtaking big victory for the USA came yesterday at the Olympics in Sochi when Merle Davis and Charlie White won the country's first ever gold medal in ice dancing.
For the first time ever, there's a U.S. ice dance team that will stand on the top step of the podium at the Olympics. Merle Davis, Charlie White are the gold medalists.
Over-the-top audio there, courtesy of NBC, of course, which is the host of broadcasting the games. Merle and Charlie defeated the Canadians, and they were the defending gold medal holders from 4 years ago. Joining us now is Colleen O'Connor, one half of the first American team to ever win a medal of any kind in ice dancing at the games, a bronze back in 1976. Colleen, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
So pretty exciting stuff watching what was going on in Sochi, and I bet it took you back to 76.
Oh, very exciting. I remember those moments. White and Davis were just incredible yesterday.
And what did they have that really impressed the judges? A lot of people talked about athleticism, but it's really about the partnership as much as anything.
Well, they had skated together for 17 years. So they had the unison. They had the total package. I never felt as though they were ever going to make a mistake because they were so well trained and had spent so many years together.
And how do you spend that much time together to make a partnership like this work? I mean, everything has to be clicking to get a gold medal.
First of all, it's the passion for the sport. They obviously love what they're doing, and their chemistry clicked. You spend a lot of hours together on that ice. I think they said 6 hours a day, which is the same amount of hours that my partner and I practiced. So it's definitely almost like a marriage, except you leave that day and you come back the next day, hopefully being on the same page and the same mindset to be more productive than the day before.
And your partner's name was Jim Milnes, right?
Correct.
And, I mean, I have to ask you this. I mean, my audience will write me all sorts of nasty emails, but you guys are still speaking, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, Jim lives in Florida. He also coaches ice skating, and we've remained very close friends.
And so it is like a marriage. I mean, when it is clicking, when it is that magical partnership, I mean, it's a lifetime thing.
It is, and it's so amazing. I mean, I think that White and Davis deserve the gold medal. Just for the fact of the years that they've put into it, they were together since their childhood days.
They grew up almost, you know, next door to each other in Detroit. That's where they began skating together. Talk to me a little bit about why ice dancing seems to have such a kind of emotional center to it.
To be a great ice dancer, you need to be very polished on the ice. Your basics need to be perfected. You're not selling yourself with the quadruple jumps. It's a lot like ballroom dancing. It's just purely skating.
And it's just, it sounds like, at least from the way you're talking, it just sounds like it's more fun.
Oh, it's a lot more fun. You know, you have to find your niche in skating. Some people are more inclined to want to jump, jump, jump. I was more inclined to want to dance with my partner. I didn't have the guts, as you might say, to be thrown up in the air and do the dangerous tricks that the pair skaters do.
I'm certainly not going to question your guts, but do you have any final thoughts for those two, Merle and Charlie, winning the gold in Sochi?
Oh, just that I'm so proud of them to bring a gold medal to the United States and put us on the top of the podium and recognition with the rest of the world that the United States can dominate ice dancing.
Well done. And well done, Colleen O'Connor. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Colleen O'Connor, along with Jim Milnes, won a bronze medal at the 1976 Innsbruck Winter Olympics, the first U.S. team to ever win an Olympic medal of any kind in ice dancing. Lose yourself to dance. Lose yourself to dance. The church's role in politics is as old as the slogan, "In God We Trust." The evangelical movement's association with the Republican Party is a relatively recent phenomenon, though. Various denominations have found themselves as activists for Republicans or Democrats down through U.S. history. But since the 1960s, the abortion issue has pushed many religious groups solidly into the Republican camp. But could that be changing? Brendan Robertson is founder of the Revangelical Movement, an organization that promotes an alternative evangelical perspective. He joins me now. Brendan Robertson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
So why are evangelicals traditionally associated with the Republican Party, and why do you believe that can change?
You know, that's a question I think that a lot of millennial evangelicals are scratching their heads at and asking. The history of the religious right movement among evangelicals started about maybe 50 years ago with people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. And from this end of history, it looks like there was a lot to do with gaining a political platform in the United States and kind of having a prominent position of power. And I think that what's changing among millennial evangelicals is that we're looking back at that history of the religious right and people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who I have no relation to, by the way, and the things that they stand for seem so inconsistent with Jesus, which is what we're all about as evangelical Christians.
And, you know, one of the ironies is that Jerry Falwell and the religious right, certainly under Reagan in the 1980s, while they got a prominent position in terms of their message, they never really got anything politically from the Republican Party in terms of actual legislation. Reagan, according to many evangelicals, sold them out.
Looking back at the history, that's what we repeatedly see, is that there's not actual much gain that comes from it, but there is definitely a platform that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Now, do you think that your vision of evangelical Christianity could match what some activist Catholics did in the 1980s, along with the evangelicals, although they were with the Democratic Party? They were very much against U.S. policy in El Salvador, for instance, created a sanctuary movement within their churches. Are you talking about those kinds of politics, or are you just talking about shifting your hat from Republican to Democrat?
Yeah, I definitely think there could be parallels. But one thing I want to emphasize is that what's not happening is that millennial evangelicals aren't switching from conservative to liberal. We're not simply just responding in a cynical way. What's actually going on is we're looking again, we're reexamining the words of Jesus, we're reexamining the principles that we claim to live our lives by from a religious perspective. And that's causing us to change on views on things like poverty and immigration reform. And we're even looking at things like marriage equality, where we might have a traditional evangelical theology of homosexuality, but we look at that and see that it has no contradiction with the political position that the LGBTQ community has the right to get married. And
so in a sense, you're struggling with the same kinds of contradictions that Pope Francis is struggling with within the Catholic Church, in the sense that neither the left nor the right represent a clear vision of what he believes Christianity to be and what I presume you believe Christianity to be.
Absolutely. Pope Francis is quickly becoming the spokesperson for a whole bunch of disengaged, disenthralled evangelicals, Catholics, Christians all across the line.
Would you say you have any numbers behind you? Is it just Brendan and a couple of his friends? Or what's the sort of momentum that you might have to actually make this a movement?
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's certainly not a Brendan thing. When I started this off maybe 5 years ago, really transitioning from a fundamentalist right-wing political perspective, and the blinders kind of were removed, and I began to see that there are thousands upon thousands of young evangelicals, many of them in Washington right now doing some significant things, like Josh Dubois, who is the president's spiritual advisor, all these young evangelicals who come from a conservative perspective and yet are seeing that, yeah, my theology may remain the same, but the politics need to match the theology, and that's not what the religious right, that's not what the Democrats or the Republicans are standing for. We want to stand for the common good of all people.
Speaking to us from Chicago, founder of the Revangelical Movement, Brendan Robertson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
So is Brendan Robertson, founder of the Revangelical Movement, who we just spoke to, is he part of a movement or an outlier? It was a little hard for him to answer the question, so we wanted to pose it to Krista Tippett, host of the public radio show On Being, which explores spirituality and religion in everyday life. She's also the author of Speaking of Faith. Welcome back, Krista.
Good to be with you again, John.
So what do you think? Is he an outlier? The fact that he's an outlier doesn't necessarily diminish his significance, but I can't tell if there's a real movement to rebrand politically the evangelical movement in America right now.
Well, I'd like to be a little bit provocative and, you know, pull the lens back farther. I actually think the moral majority was the outlier. The people we have come to call identify as evangelicals now are the same group who in the early 20th century withdrew from politics, withdrew from public life, said, in fact, you know, this is the age of world war and global economic depression. They said, we are going to focus on inner life. We're going to focus on personal salvation. What you had in the late 20th century, and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, you know, really came to represent this, was this strident reaction against this, this reemergence into the public sphere. But they never represented all evangelicals, you know. And I also want journalists to get a bit of credit here. There was this kind of, you know, suddenly people were talking about, wow, 40% of the American public is evangelical. And they were lumping all those people into a box. But 40% of the American people is and has always been a very diverse group of voices. So I think that what Brendan represents is the untold story that started to happen immediately after the turn of the century through the Bush administration of evangelicals themselves and not just millennials, you know, rebelling against this being represented by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson in the public sphere and looking back at their core values and really, again, all those stereotypes and those boxes about who evangelicals are and what they believe. It was a very short-lived thing, and it never was the whole story.
Well, by that analysis, the moral majority becomes less of an outlier and more just the tip of the parade, the beginning band in the parade of a much more diverse group of people looking for a home. You mentioned the beginning of the 20th century and this withdrawal from public life. You know, the temperance movement in the 1800s was a hugely church-driven movement, which also helped to spawn feminism. And so, you know, if you go back far enough, the church is very central to politics in America.
Well, absolutely. And all across the spectrum, as you say, you know, the Seneca Falls meeting was held in a church. It's Christians in this country and people who we would call evangelicals. Again, you know, that label is a little bit misleading and tricky. It's been used in different ways. But these were the people who fought against slavery. You know, and also, again, I do want to make my point that I think journalism shares a lot of the blame. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson made for great sound bites. They were entertaining, right? But all along, even in those years, you had people like Ron Sider at Evangelicals for Social Action. You had Jim Wallace and the Sojourners Community. You had stunning things happening in the National Association of Evangelicals during the George W. Bush administration. Evangelical leaders saying, we do care about abortion. It's not theologically right for us. We do care. We do believe that the church should not condone gay marriage, but saying our agenda, our social agenda, must be much broader. You know, as Brandon said, picking up on global poverty, really beginning to think about climate change and the natural world, and finding ways that at the heart of the Bible and Christian theology, evangelicals wanted to be weighing in on this. So it's been a more complex picture that just wasn't covered. And then I think Brandon and these millennial, this next generation of evangelicals are really gaining a public voice and expressing something.
Let me go back to one of the details you mentioned, and I don't want to sort of date us, but I think the Seneca Falls meeting being held in a church needs some explanation. Okay. Certainly that was the beginning of a very important moment on the left in American politics, but how do you see it?
I guess what, you know, the larger point I'm trying to make is it's still complicated that the stereotypes don't fit, that evangelicals fall on one side of the spectrum. It didn't fit when the Seneca Falls meeting, which was a core moment in, you know, what we would later call women's liberation, happened in a holiness church. It didn't fit in the early 20th century when we started to think evangelicals are people who primarily are against abortion and against gay rights. And now the picture is more complicated, too, as Brandon said. You know, the last time I looked at statistics about young evangelicals, you would have a picture that might look politically confusing. You might have them being less in favor of abortion, far more in favor than their parents' generation on LGBT issues and certainly on gay marriage. And then you might have them very, very activist in issues, even partnering with liberals on issues that we've come to see as liberal issues, like, again, immigration, global poverty, climate change. But here's the key. Sometimes when these young evangelicals also, let's say they will say to you, theologically, abortion is something they oppose. But they're trying to find, as they would say, faithful ways to take that up as an issue. So even if they hold that position, which looks like a Republican position, they may not be finding it a useful way to spend their energy working on the legality of abortion or the constitutional right. They, a lot of them, are saying, okay, if we're against abortion in our church, we have to create a community that models what's at stake here in human terms, where we are helping people avoid pregnancy, where if someone becomes pregnant and they don't want to be, we as a community take that on as a responsibility. So again, even when the values look Republican or Democrat, it may be a theological and ecclesiastical response rather than a political response.
It's about the people of faith, not the institutions, which is something that Pope Francis may beginning to unlock there at the Vatican. Krista Tippett, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Krista Tippett, host of the public radio show On Being and the author of Speaking of Faith. Well, since we're bashing journalists there with Krista Tippett a moment ago, you may not have heard of the movie, the actor, or the screenwriter, but it's very likely you know this moment.
I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change.
How many stations does this go out?
You've got to get mad.
67.
You've got
to
say,
I know it goes to Louisville and Atlanta.
I'm not going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
The idea of being mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, live on the air, the voice of actor Peter Finch as TV anchor, the words of legendary screenwriter and Hollywood renegade Paddy Chayefsky are immortal, regardless of what you think of the film. The 1976 film directed by Sidney Lumet won 4 Academy Awards, but its influence on the culture of America, news, and Hollywood goes far beyond that. To watch the movie Network today is to take a trip in a disorienting time machine, only to arrive at the present moment.
I've been telling you people since I took this job 6 months ago that I want angry shows.
I don't want conventional programming on this network. I want counterculture. I want anti-establishment. I don't want to play butch boss with people. But when I took over this department, it had the worst programming record in television history. This network hasn't one show in the top 20. This network is an industry joke. And we better start putting together one winner for next September. I want a show developed based on the activities of a terrorist group. Joseph Stalin and his merry band of Bolsheviks. I want ideas from you people. That is what you're paid for.
Ideas, people. That's Faye Dunaway there as Diana Christensen setting the agenda for UBS, the film network's fictional TV network. Dave Itzkoff, culture reporter at the New York Times, is author of a new book that is a fabulous window on the past. It's all about the classic film. It's called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Dave, welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right, so let's start right here. Network, the film, invented Fox News, yes?
I think you could say that it anticipated everything that's happening in cable news right now, not just Fox, but the whole spectrum of, you know, speak your mind news programs.
So it invented Keith Olbermann, who blurbs your book, by the way.
I think that any TV news journalist right now would say that network is an accurate description of their competitors. Maybe not them, but their competitors.
Network invented modern political campaigns.
I think that is a very likely possibility that, yes, it was all about emotion and not about fact.
In that script by Paddy Chayefsky is the invention of reality TV.
Absolutely. When you have, as we just heard, Faye Dunaway, a TV executive, wanting, you know, a reality-based show about bank robbers and criminals and terrorists, are we really that far away from that?
But Paddy Chayefsky, as a person, as a screenwriter, as a character in Hollywood, did not take his anger from some shelf of virtue and vision and virtue. I can't. There's no other word for it. He was just a really angry guy.
He was a very cantankerous personality, but I think he came by his anger honestly. It was something that was built up over the period of, let's say, a two-decade-long career. First, in the golden age of television, where of course he wrote TV plays like Marty, which became the Academy Award-winning right. film. Then he had a kind of peripatetic career in live theater. Kind of got burnt out on that. Got burnt out even on motion pictures. Tried to make a return to TV, and eventually we get to Network in 1976. So he's pretty disappointed and disillusioned in a lot of things by then.
Network comes out in the bicentennial year, and news media, including Walter Cronkite, are very angry by this movie. It didn't get great reviews, which we'll talk about in a second, but he was really hurt by the criticism he got from network executives and anchors.
Yeah, that's one of the things that comes up in the book that, I mean, first of all, he got a lot of access to the network news broadcasts at CBS and NBC, who let him just come in and observe and take notes. He didn't know what kind of movie he was going to write. They had no idea what kind of film he was going to create. Then it comes out, it's very deeply satirical, not particularly positively disposed to television broadcasting. And the TV newscasters who think of themselves as unassailable, unimpeachable, these paragons of the truth, they're wounded by it, and they take it out directly on Chayefsky.
Frank Rich called it a mess, but I'm wondering if what he really meant was it's so far ahead of his time, because when Broadcast News came out a decade later by James L. Brooks, it was a tame restatement of almost the exact same issues.
Well, I think Broadcast News, I mean, that has a lot more heart and sentiment. There's a real love story in it.
It's a cheesy Hollywood movie.
I like it a little better than you.
I like
do.
It too.
But I totally take your point. I mean, even the critics who liked Network in the time that it came out, even its supporters, everybody sort of agreed, oh, this is outlandish. This could never happen. And I think that's what you see the critics responding to. Not that they find it funny or not funny. It's that it seems outrageous to them that this could ever come to pass.
Let's talk a little bit about some of Paddy Chayefsky's other domains here. We have a clip from the movie Altered States, which is an amazing movie that probably could never be made today. Here's William Hurt in – I would just want to give you a sense of the big ideas that Paddy Chayefsky could not put down. And here is William Hurt in Altered States.
Memory is energy. It doesn't disappear. It's still in there. There's a physiological pathway to our earlier consciousnesses. There has to be, and I'm telling you, it's in the limbic system.
Jessica, you're a wacko.
What's wacko about it, Mason? I'm a man in search of his true self. How artifically American can you get? Everybody's looking for their true selves. We're all trying to fulfill ourselves.
Ever since we dispensed with God, we've got nothing but ourselves to explain this meaningless horror of life.
You're a wacko.
You're a wacko. Patty Chayefsky must have been told that a lot. Is William Hurt channeling Chayefsky, do you think, with those lines from Altered States?
Oh, I think you can certainly make the case, if you look at the breadth of Chayefsky's career, that every one of his protagonists is some form of him. Certainly, Network was his magnum opus, and Altered States, which is a kind of a modern-day Jekyll and Hyde tale. I mean, he tried to push things even further, just sort of transcending the ideas of society and it going into the individual soul and personality and what constitutes that. That's some tough stuff to get across on the screen.
But very much predicting Peter Weir's career as a director who went in this place, psychedelic drugs and sort of religious experiences, helping secular Americans to understand the truth.
Yeah, I think there was certainly an understanding. That came out in 81, still very valid today, this idea of just the absence of identity and how do you get to your inner self.
Do you think you would have liked him?
I would have liked him. The question is, would he have liked me? And that's very hard to say. It's hard. You know, the people that he sort of let into his inner circle were a motley crew. I mean, the people that really supported his vision and ideas and let him do exactly what he wanted. Those are the people that he liked best. I don't know how he would have felt about, New York Times reporter who wants to write about his life story.
Aaron Sorkin seems to believe he would have liked you.
That's
of course,
kind.
Nobody who likes Aaron Sorkin. Right?
That's kind of Aaron to say. I would never. I was very thrilled to be able to tell Chayefsky's life story. I feel very uneasy about anticipating what he would have thought about anything. He didn't like a lot of things.
David Itzkoff, culture reporter at the New York Times, author of Mad as Hell, The Making of Network, and The Fateful Visions of the Angriest Man in Movies. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So when news went 24 hours, how did you feel about that? For Portland, Oregon, one of you said, bad. It's given us a generation of pseudo-journalists who care more about getting it first than getting it right, and they never admit they got it wrong.
My name is Cameron Buzar-Jamari, and I'm calling from Orlando, Florida. You don't need to listen to news all the time, but you need to be mindful of who you're listening to when you do.
Listeners have the power. Don't we say that all the time on The Takeaway? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Check us online at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.